It's a holiday Monday for all of you. It is not for John Shannon and I. We are stuck at home.
Well, not stuck.
Well, I'm stuck. Aren't you stuck?
Just
gardening all weekend.
Yeah, but that's supposed to be fun, Bob.
Really?
Yeah.
Who taught you that?
Well, you hire someone.
Your wife convinced you that this is a fun thing to do, John. You should do this and be happy doing it.
No, the only thing I would tell you, Bob, is the plants don't talk back. That's the nice thing about plants.
I'll give you that much.
So, you know, you're out there. The weather's normally nice. It's pretty good out there with me and my friends.
Well, either get rid of the plants or get rid of the wife. One of the two things, you know, and life will be perfect. Hold on.
Is this you giving me advice?
Well, I'm imparting words of wisdom.
Oh, okay.
As a man of great experience in this regard. As
Experience in gardening, obviously, because...
No, I have no experience in gardening. So take of that what you will.
Okay.
We got a lot of stuff to discuss here. Oh, and by the way, for those of you who are listening, driving down from your luxurious cottages or whatever the hell you're doing on this holiday Monday, we decided not to bug anybody else. So we're just going to bug you ourselves.
Yeah.
Just Shannon and
I might get in the title because of this.
No, you won't.
Oh.
So here's the story of the weekend, essentially. I mean, there are a bunch of stories, and we're going to try and touch on as many as we can get to. But Novak Djokovic is losing to Carreño Busta in, I want to say the fourth round of the U.S. Open, but it doesn't really matter what round it is. And is down 6-5 in the first set. And has a ball in his hands, is walking along the baseline and smacks the ball towards the back wall in the general direction of the ball person. But the ball hits a lines person in the throat, and a female, and she goes down in some discomfort. It is clear. Djokovic immediately throws his hands up and, you know, as if to say, oh God, I didn't mean to do that, and walks over to her, checks to see how she is. He is there for, I don't know, 10 seconds, whatever. He's got his hand on her back. We don't know what he said to her. I'm not here to defend Djokovic, but I want to put everything into context because I think this has gotten a little carried away for those of you who haven't seen it. And rightly, under the rules and regulations, Djokovic is suspended by the USTA and is kicked out of the United States Open as the number one seed. And look, you never know, but probably about to win another major championship. To you, right call, wrong call, or the only call they could make?
Well, when you consider that tennis rules are really about on the line, off the line, and it's now gone to a science of technology, I think it's the only ruling they could make. I didn't like it. I think it was a complete and utter accident. I didn't even, you know, he didn't. It wasn't as if it was complete anger, in my opinion, and he swiped the ball back to the back of the court. And as soon as he realized what he had done, he was in complete distress is the bad word, but
complete an apologetic
sympathy.
Mode.
In complete sympathy, absolutely. So the rules are the rules, and so if you do it for Djokovic. And you don't do it for the qualifier, then you've got a problem. This guy's a marked man, though, in many ways when it comes to tennis right now. I mean, whether it comes from his COVID tournament earlier in the year,
right?
He's a polarizing guy in the game. I felt bad for the line judge, but I really felt bad for him in the end.
I did too.
Because
I did too, and I'm not overtly sympathetic to Djokovic.
I wonder, Bob, it's very easy to do now, but I wonder if there were people in the building. I wonder if the stands were full when people buy their tickets to see the stars. I wonder if the ruling would have been different.
Oh, no, I think it would have been exactly the same. In fact, it probably would have been perceived as worse because those New York fans would have booed the hell out of them.
They were buying tickets. They would have bought tickets to watch him play because he's that good.
Well, let me ask you this. The ball hits this female judge in the throat, and she goes down. And my first reaction was, if the ball had hit her in the shoulder, at the speed at which it was hit, it would have been insignificant in terms of her health. She would not have been injured by it.
Right, right.
Would the USTA have suspended him in that account?
Well, again, the rule is if you hit someone with the ball, it doesn't say where you hit them with the ball. The ruling probably would have and should have been the same.
Did he do it in anger?
No, there's no way he did it in anger. There's no way.
Some level of frustration, but
no, only to himself, not to someone else.
No. And we have to point out two things. Number one, Denis Shapovalov becomes the first Canadian to make it to the final eight.
Right.
In the United States Open, and there may be two more today. By the time people are listening to this, Pospisil and Ogier Aliassime may indeed join him, and wouldn't that be something? But at this point, when we are recording this, it's just Shapovalov. Let us not forget that not so long ago, Denis Shapovalov lost his temper and smashed a ball that hit the chair umpire. I don't remember if it was in the cheek or the eye, but it was pretty close to the eye, and likewise was suspended. But that ball was hit in absolute anger and was hit hard. That was not what happened with Djokovic.
No, no. To me, they're two vastly different issues. This one, I mean, any replay I've seen of him today or even late last night, it was, oh, my goodness. He was in as much shock as anybody. It goes to the black and white of the rules of tennis versus what exactly happened. And I think in the end, it's a shame. I bet you the TV networks are not happy that he's out because he's still a draw. But the rules and the integrity of tennis have to be enforced, I suppose.
I guess so. I have read the rule book or the rule.
Yeah.
It's been published. It's pretty clear. I don't think there's grounds for an appeal here. I suppose the thing that concerns me the most, or the only thing that concerns me, is the way the tennis community is reacting to this.
As if it was
far more significant than it was. In any event, we invite people to watch the video. It's available all over the place if you didn't see it live, and judge for yourself.
Yeah, the only thing I would say about the tennis community reacting to it is how social media reacts to anything. I mean, it's always over the top. That's a fact of life now, Bob.
I guess you're right.
I wouldn't even worry about that for him. I think it's one of those ones where perhaps, and it won't happen because tennis just doesn't do this. Perhaps the rule needs to be reinterpreted.
Have you watched much of this U.S. Open?
I haven't. I did watch yesterday.
You watched Shapovalov last night?
I watched the end. I must admit, I didn't watch it. I was busy.
I watched most of it. Beat Goff in 6-7, 6-3, 6-4, 6-3. And it was interesting because the first set, they went to a tiebreaker.
Right.
and Goffin wiped him out 7-0. So it looked like Goffin, who had beaten, I don't think Shapovalov had beaten Goffin before, I may be wrong, but Goffin looked like the better player and looked like Shapovalov was on his way to a yet another defeat, but then kind of steamrolled him. I was reasonably impressed by Shapovalov's performance, although I must say I think he could use a little more variety in his game, and I'm kind of surprised that we don't see that. He just basically hits it hard, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I wonder if he can sustain this through the final.
Well, that's like a pitcher. You need more than one pitch, right?
Well, it raises the question of so Pospisil knocks off Raonic, which was really quite surprising. And Pospisil is just one of those guys who just hangs around and hangs around and hangs around and never really does anything great. But every once in a while jumps up and bites somebody. And I don't think any of us have the confidence that he can be, you know, the first Canadian to win a U.S. Open on the men's side. Ogier Aliassim, on the other hand, seems to me to have a much more complete game than either Pospisil or Shapovalov. I don't know how much you've seen of this kid play, but
not much at all. Not much at all. But I'll tell you what, from what you read and what you hear, his pure athleticism is something that is, and they're all great athletes, but his pure athleticism is the thing that I think puts him in great stead.
Well, he can move around the court like crazy. He can get to almost any ball that anybody can get to. And he has the full variety of shots.
Yeah.
Probably doesn't hit his ground strokes nearly as hard as Shapovalov. Certainly doesn't hit his serve as hard as Raonic. No one does. But in terms of all-around game, he's got just about all the pieces. You never know. Some of these guys come and go, you know, as fast as, you know, they come and they explode and then they disappear. But this guy's got a chance at least to be.
The interesting thing is that when you look at where men's tennis is in Canada and where the growth is, the growth has really come in the last five to seven years. A lot of it because of guys like Raonic, you know, and so in the end, the guy that we expected to be the first big winner is actually going to probably be surpassed by some of the guys he actually helped inspire in many ways when you think about the young guys versus what Milos is going through right now.
Moving on. Stars beat the Golden Knights 1-0 in the first game of the Western Conference final. It was it put my feet to sleep. You know, look at, if you're a hockey puck, every game is interesting. And what did you take away from that one? Anything?
Well,
clearly not, because you're not.
It is the classic case of what happens in the third round of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Meaning?
Is that by the time the teams have gotten to this point, there's just not near the energy to start the playoff round. And what happened was, obviously, Vegas had little or no energy. They had played, they're finishing 3 games in 4 days. Dallas had an extra day off and realized the only way they were going to win the game was to play a you know, 110% defensive style of hockey and keep Vegas out of the middle of the ice. I mean, Vegas at after the second period, Bob, only had 12 shots. And that's, you know, that with what we saw with them against Vancouver in the previous series, just was such a contradiction of where they were and what they were. You know, I think that Rick Bowness knows that the only way he's going to beat Dallas, or beat Vegas rather, is if they play a slower paced, you know, for want of a better word, a dull version of hockey. And then hope that they can hold them off. And right now, Vegas is having a difficult time scoring, not just against Dallas, but they had a terrible time scoring against Vancouver the last 3 games.
Yeah.
So the last four games, that they've played in these playoffs, they've scored two goals with goaltenders in the crease. Two.
Yeah, I know.
And if I'm not for lack of
opportunities.
Oh, no, no. But there was not many opportunities last night.
But before that, in the Vancouver series, they had tons of chances.
I mean, Mark Stone was stymied last night completely. Pacioretty, I think, had three shots. If not for their defense, if not for Shea Weber and Nate Schmidt, I don't know where the Vegas offense would have been, because between the two of them, they had eight or nine of the 25 shots. It was, to me, this was a classic case of, okay, the only way we're going to win is we're going to dull it down. And you talked about hockey pucks would like it. There's a lot of hockey pucks that wouldn't like it. There's a lot of hockey pucks that were going to have a difficult time getting involved and getting interested in last night. And then there'd be a few guys saying, oh my goodness, what a machine that was. Rick Bowness after the game said, that's Dallas Stars hockey. Well, and I've known Rick a long time, and I think Rick's one of the great people of the game, and I'm thrilled for him to get this far. But this was just, okay, we're going to dummy it down. We're going to keep it simple. We're going to push them to the outside, and we've got a chance to win.
Yeah, it's a crock of shit is what it is. And, I mean, we all know it, but that's what coaches do. Look, I want to address one more thing before we move on. Stop laughing. Fleury in goal last night.
Yep.
Can you figure out what DeBoer is thinking when it comes to his goaltenders? Is he flipping a coin?
Bob, we've talked about this. We've talked about this.
Is there
when we had Scotty on? When we had Scotty on 2 weeks ago, we started talking about the Vegas goaltending, and I told you that day, Robin Lehner is going to be the starting goalie for this team. Robin Lehner's the starting goalie for this team.
So why are you playing Fleury in game one?
Because you're appeasing. You're appeasing your fan base. You're appeasing the goaltender. The other guy has just afforded
to listen to your fan base.
The other guy
has your fan base. You should not be a coach in the National.
Last night, Pete DeBoer had nothing to lose. Here's why: Robin Lehner's this guy of the future. They're going to sign Lehner to a long-term contract. He's going to be in Vegas. What they're going to do with Marc-Andre Fleury is another story. We don't know yet. DeBoer, his number one guy, has played 3 games in 4 days. Has looked good. Shut out Canucks 3 times in the series.
Including the last game he played.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That way, you know, here's the thing. And this is you love playing both sides of the coin on this one, Bob, because sometimes shutouts are team defense. Robin Lehner probably had 7 difficult saves in game 7 against Vancouver.
I get it. You know what I'm saying.
So here's the point. So Pete DeBoer is sitting there saying, okay, I'm in royal hot water with Fleury, with his agent, with the fan base. Who knows if I'm in hot water with our pal McPhee? Don't know that. Who knows? And so what am I going to do? If I played Leonard last night and we lose, what do I do now? So what he's going to do is he's going to make Marc-Andre Fleury the sacrificial lamb and play him in game 1. And if he wins, well, we just played the best guy and Robin was tired after 3 and 4, and I'm going to go back to Leonard. And if he loses, well, I'm going back to Leonard. Pete DeBoer had nothing to lose last night, because in the end, there's a little bit of non-winning messaging in all this of where Marc-Andre Fleury fits into the system and the Golden Knights.
Well, we all know you defend everything that happens in hockey, and
I'm not defending Pete DeBoer
for all of this. Well, it's just decide on who your goaltender is. You're in the Stanley Cup semifinal.
They have decided.
Then play him. Did you give Stone the night off? Did you give Pacioretty the night off? Did you give Theodore the night off? Did you give players who are out there for 20, 25 minutes skating their asses off the night off? No, but a goaltender is too tired to play a fourth game or a third game in four nights. That's a
no. It would have been a fourth game in six nights.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. A goaltender ought to be able to play triple headers every day.
Well, what position did you play?
Goaltender.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah. I know you don't get that tired. Bob, I mean, if you Bob, hurt yourself.
Bob, when you played, you never fell down. It was up.
No, I was on my knees or on my ass all the time, sliding across the crease because I had a crappy defense.
This was a Pete DeBoer. I had nothing to lose. I'm going to play this guy, and then I'm going to be a hero to some people.
A stupid coach.
Because the fan base.
Forget the fan base, for God's sake.
The fan base
doesn't care, and the fan base in Vegas still doesn't know enough about hockey to offer a valid opinion about it.
The fan base loves Marc-Andre Fleury.
Well, I give you that.
The fan base knows he is the face of the franchise for now, but he's not going to be for long. I mean, I found it interesting. There's a commercial on the air because somebody in an ad agency in Toronto thought, "Well, who's going to go a long way in the conference in the playoffs? Oh, Vegas is. Well, who are the two most popular guys on the team? Well, Mark Stone and Marc-Andre Fleury." Well, when that commercial was produced, there's no chance. There's no chance they thought that Marc-Andre Fleury was not going to play.
Oh, well.
And that's what it's all about, Bob. Those are the types of things that have really, I mean, this is a bittersweet time for Fleury too. And he's been very good publicly, but I can guarantee you in his heart of hearts, he's not very, very happy.
Of course he's not. He was the number one goaltender there since the day.
Goaltender. He sacrificed a lot to go to Vegas and help build the franchise.
Thank you. And he did all the things they asked him to do. You know, you can look it up on YouTube or whatever. I mean, you know, right from day one, he was there signing uniforms, going to the rink before they even had a practice.
Sure.
You know, on and on and on. All right, let's get off that bandwagon.
Well, the night of the, even going all the way back to the night of the expansion draft, who flies into town, you know, and
Marc-Andre, yeah, I know.
And gets presented to come out in front of this crowd with the expansion draft. I mean, that to me, that's what, I think that's what irks a lot of people. We talked about it with Jim and Darren on Friday about where is the loyalty, well, in lots of businesses, but where is the loyalty in sports? And unfortunately, it goes away quickly.
All right, so let me ask you this.
If you feel you need it to win.
Did his performance during the course of this season validate the decision to bring the other guy in? Was he bad enough that they felt they couldn't win with him?
No.
What changed was
the philosophy in January when they brought in a new coach. When they fired Gerard Gallant and brought
for
in
whatever reason didn't like Fleury.
I don't think that he dislikes Fleury. But what I can tell you is he likes big goaltenders.
Well,
and I'll tell you what, his nickname's Panda for a reason. He's a big goaltender.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Marc-Andre Fleury is likely to grow taller or wider in the near future.
Well, if he came on a road trip with us, he might grow wider.
Tent with you. I'm svelte now, John, so I don't have to worry about that.
Oh, excuse me.
Tampa Bay Islanders, depending on when people listen to this, they may have played a game or two in this series, but it does go today. This seems like a no-brainer to me.
Really?
I think Tampa Bay, I'm impressed by what the Islanders have done. But Tampa Bay has been a very, very good team for several years and have shown very few signs during the playoffs. During the regular season, they were a little iffy, especially early on.
Yeah.
But they have seemed to figure it out. and no Stamkos again.
No. For the whole series.
Yeah, but they've gone through that before. They've probably played more games since Stamkos went there without him than they have with him. So, I mean, he's a good player. I don't know if he's a great player, but I thought he was going to be a great player, but the injuries have been a problem for him. And
when he listen, he is not two things. Stamkos has not been the same since he broke his leg in Boston, and then he's had other issues with blood clotting. If you could find a way to put all his health issues aside, he has the greatness in him. It's just that I think now that you have to wonder if his body can actually allow him to be great again. But you think Tampa's this is like 5 games, 6 games?
Yeah, I think so.
I think the Islanders are winning, Bob.
Well, we'll see.
I mean, what do you mean we'll see? I think the Islanders are winning.
Well,
I think that
I said we'll see. Is it too difficult for you to comprehend and understand?
I just don't think that
we'll see.
I just don't think you know that how deep the Islanders are, how good their blue line is, and
maybe I don't.
And their and their goaltending, which is a true tandem goaltending system. I think the Islanders will win the series. In fact, now I think the Islanders will win the Stanley Cup.
So you think Barry Trotz is the better coach?
I think Barry Trotz is a better coach. Yeah, and I like John Cooper.
And you think? Well, you can't be both. You can't play both sides of the fence, as you often try and do.
I do all the time.
Yes, and you think Lou Lamoriello is a better general manager?
I think Lou Lamoriello is a legend.
I love Lou Lamoriello. I don't know Trotz very well. We've talked to him once or twice on the show, but I mean, you know, You go by what you see, and what I see is an Islander team that is overachieved, in my opinion.
Wow.
And I see a Tampa Bay team that is peaking. And when that happens, John, I'm going with the team that is peaking.
Okay. Now,
let's move on to a couple of other things. Oh, there are two, at least, high-profile, and probably three high-profile candidates for the Washington Capitals head coaching job. Mike Babcock and Gerard Gallant have both been, it's been acknowledged that both of them have interviewed for the job. And yeah. I, if not you and I, think that there's a very good chance that Bruce Boudreau is in the mix there as well. Babcock, Gallant, Boudreau. Can you ever remember three more accomplished coaches all being available at the same time?
You better add one more name there. You better add Peter Laviolette, who's got his name on the Stanley Cup as well as one of the key candidates. But I haven't
heard. Have you heard Laviolette?
Oh, yeah, he's interviewed. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so
you put Peter into there. Those are four really big names.
So, who would you choose?
Sentimentally, I'd pick Bruce. I can't argue
with you.
You know, when you look at Bruce's winning percentage,
unbelievable.
It's off the charts. It's in the top five of all time greats.
But the problem is it's
only in the regular season, and that's Granted. Bruce's issue. That's Bruce's biggest issue is that his numbers. I think it's 6.634 winning percentage. Is our regular season numbers. What happens in playoffs? I can't answer that. But at the same time, I mean, I think here's the one thing I really believe that is a positive for Bruce in all this is this is a fan base now that, I mean, I just can't imagine. And as an aside, I can't imagine them spending big money on Mike Babcock when they wouldn't spend that same type of money on Barry Trotz and they would have never lost their coach. That to me is one of the shocking things. And I do think that the ownership there at one point, Ted Leonsis thought that coaches were dime a dozen. And now he's realized that no, coaches are a little more important than what you think. So to me, I, by the way, I think all four will be in the NHL within the next 12 months. But I would like to see Bruce get another chance in Washington, because I think the fan base needs to be energized again. And I think that when you put somebody who is as popular as Bruce is back in that market, you do some, you might, when you can sell tickets, you would sell tickets. And I think, and have better TV ratings. One quick story, Barry Trotz, who was there for and won a Stanley Cup with the Caps, was always frustrated, very quietly, was always frustrated because everywhere he went in Washington in the 4 years he was there, the first question people said is, how's Bruce doing? Where's Bruce? And so Bruce had made such an impact in the marketplace with the fan base that he probably deserves another chance to be the coach.
With John Shannon, this is just the two of us, which it's actually pretty good, because if we had anybody else in, they wouldn't get a word in edgewise.
Well, then, and when we put the new title in featuring, it'll be fantastic.
No, when you get your own podcast, You can put the John Shannon podcast featuring John Shannon, starring John Shannon. With John Shannon.
Well, I noticed you got a couple of Twitter accounts. You got Fadu, and then you got the Bob McCowan podcast.
I don't have any. Our producer does all that crap for me. I don't have any. No.
But you take credit for it.
No, I don't take any credit for it.
Oh.
I just found one like a week ago that has been up for years, apparently. I didn't even know it existed.
Oh.
Raptors lost game 2. 5 days ago, I tweeted the following. Raptors down 2-0 to Celtics, but this is exactly where they sat last year versus the Bucks, and we know what happened there. .. The response, I need to tell you, was absurd.
I told you not to listen to social media, Bob.
Well, I got speared all over the place, you know. Everybody took shots at me. They said the Raptors are dead. They'll go down in 4 straight. They're not as good as Boston. They're blah, 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 blah. Well, these, of course, are stupid people who are really not paying attention. I, of course, as you well know, Shannon, pay attention to every detail.
Yes, yes, you do.
And so I just posed that tweet. And here we are 5 days later, getting ready for game 5. And the series is tied at 2. And I can't admit to being overtly confident that the Raptors will beat Boston. But I am now extremely confident that they can beat Boston. And if you take out the first quarter of game 1, literally the first quarter of game 1, this series is basically a crapshoot. Remember, game 2, Raptors have a shot. Van Vliet throws up a 24-25 footer. Now, it wasn't that close, but if they make it, they win game 2.
Yeah.
They win game 3 on the miracle by Anunoby. And game 4, they were not, I wouldn't say comfortably ahead.
They were in control. They were in control. Yeah,
that, well said. That, they were in control.
Yeah.
Can Boston turn it around? Have they got a key to figure out what to do differently? I don't know. We're going to find out, aren't we?
Yeah. And it's funny because as the series started, what happened was, again, that there were a lot of the pundits that said Boston was going to be the better team and Boston was deeper. And for some reason, the Raptors, and I'm not playing the Canadian card, but for some reason, the Raptors just couldn't, even as defending champions, couldn't get enough respect from lots of people. And everybody thought that Boston was going to win the series. And the interesting thing is that how this has proceeded. I mean, every game I thought Kyle's been better, you know, and as Kyle goes, in many ways, so goes this team. And he's just, came off the ankle sprain after the last series, and I think he's been great the last two games, and done what he's had to do, and become a leader, and done such a great job. And I think that it's funny. Lots of people give Brad Stevens as one of the great basketball minds. I also think that Nick Nurse has done a really good job of changing things and being a better coach at this point, even though the series is at 2.
Well, The merits of coaching in the NBA is an argument that is not.
He looks good in the mask, though. He looks good in the mask.
Who, Stevens or Nurse?
Oh, Nick. Nick's got the, you know, the skyline of Toronto on it. Looks really good.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Well, you've got
it, this conversation.
You've got to listen. It doesn't matter. Chuck Daly of the Pistons proved that even if you're not coaching, you got to look good, Bob. You got to look good, man.
I got a box of those powder blue masks, you know, that everybody wears. Really? You have to make a fashion statement with your mask?
Why not?
Bite me.
Hold on. The guy with the sunglasses is saying you got to make a fashion statement with something on your face?
No, no. This is simply so that I can't see you when I'm supposed to see you.
Well, we've solved that problem.
No, you're on my screen right
now.
Well,
you know, you can actually change your screen to not see me.
Well, I don't know how to do that. So until I learn how to do that.
Hey, one quick thought. What do you think has happened in Milwaukee? I know, you know, they've...
Bucks?
Yeah. They have, well, I mean, this was, you know, this was a team that the Raptors beat last year, but they were, you know, I mean, Giannis was the
greatest. They almost ran the table during the regular season and then kind of stubbed their when they came back after the COVID stuff, they weren't as good.
No.
Even in the round robin. I don't even know what they went. We go 4-4, 5-3, something like that. You know, and the Raptors go 7-1. Well, hell, Phoenix went 8-0. Figure that one out. Still didn't make the play.
You wonder if they're going to, this offseason with Giannis's contract, are they going to blow things up there?
Well, we'll get to that down the road. We've got time to talk about that. But, you know, the question is, do they trade him? I think they're going to go to him and say, you know, we want you to, if I was them, I don't know what they're going to do. If I was them, I'd go to Giannis and say, look, you got one more year left. Then you become an unrestricted free agent. And we're going to get diddly squat for you.
Right.
So either you're going to re-sign right now, or we're going to trade your ass. And I mean, that's the question I would ask if I was them. And maybe I wouldn't be completely angry if he said he was going to leave. All things considered. Because maybe Milwaukee takes a look now and says, was Budenholzer the right guy to hire as a coach? Do we have this a team together that without Giannis can win?
Yeah.
Is Giannis a guy who is an isolated player as opposed to one of the five? There's all kinds of questions that Milwaukee should be asking themselves, and I don't know what the answers are going to be.
Well, I tell you what, if you're the Bucks and Giannis will tell people that he doesn't want to re-sign there, that's the best thing that could happen to the franchise.
Well, because I don't disagree with that. That's
because
sort
if they
of what I'm
because
saying.
if they say we're going to trade you anyway, I mean, it would the fan base will be in full rebellion.
Well, but you go to him and you ask the question, and if he says I'm not going to re-sign, or I won't re-sign with you now,
right?
I think then the fan base would say, okay, I understand. And then you get down to what do you get for him? And it's not going to be more cheese. They got lots of cheese in Wisconsin.
Is that the lesson you learned from Tracy McGrady way back when?
I didn't learn any lessons from Tracy McGrady, to tell you the honest to goodness truth.
Wow.
And I don't think Tracy McGrady learned any lessons from anybody else. But that's another story altogether. Look, we're over time here.
We are?
Yeah.
We just started.
No, you just started.
I was hoping you were going to explain the FedEx Cup to me.
All right. The FedEx Cup?
Oh. Yeah.
Well, I was going to go down the why is Dustin Johnson still underrated? Why don't people acknowledge him as he's the best player in the world. Whew. And he might be the best player in the world by a good distance.
Yeah.
And I like Schauffele and I like forget Tiger.
You like Rory still, don't you?
Rory's a great player. I thought Rory would deliver more. Yeah. There are other guys out there that are really good, but DJ just keeps on chugging. He's 35
years old. His short game has become so good.
He still hits it as far or further than anybody else.
Right. But you know, a lot of guys can't hit the wedge.
There's five guys on tour that can hit it as far as DJ.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. And we'll acknowledge that, including Rory. I don't think anybody in a long drive competition is sure they could beat DJ, but he can hit it as far as everybody. And the rest of his game is
lights out.
Perfection.
Lights out. It's lights out now. Absolutely.
He is really good.
People won't forget the silly mistakes.
Talk about that all the time, John. You make a mistake, you got to learn from it. You got to lose before you learn how to win.
Sure.
And that's exactly DJ's script.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no question. But people keep reminding themselves of the silly mistakes, whether it's hitting out of the bunker and grounding your club, whether it's falling down the stairs. I mean, there's tons of little things in Dustin's past that people would rather bring up than pay attention to what he's hitting from 165 and how he hits it stiff. You know?
One more before we go. The Browns, the state of Ohio has decided that their two NFL teams, the Browns of Cleveland, the Bengals of Cincinnati, will be each allowed to bring in 6,000 fans for their first two home games. Mm-hmm. The concept being, let's see how it goes. Fans must wear masks in the stadium, But that's what they're going to do. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, when you think of the size of a stadium, and you still promote social distancing and you promote wearing the mask, you can probably scatter 6,000 people through a stadium to allow everybody to sit at least 10 feet apart. And at that point, then, you know, you judge it after the two games. There's a lot of places that aren't as liberal as what they're doing in Ohio. It also speaks to the love of football in the state of Ohio, which is, let's face it, off the charts, sometimes unfairly off the charts. But when you and obviously they've probably looked at both stadiums and said, okay, if we place people here, place people here, place people here, and then they have to adhere to rules, the question is, will they adhere to the rules?
Well, so let me ask you from this standpoint. And you know, I'm a Buckeye, so, but I have no real opinion from that perspective. But here's what I do know. You could put 100, 150 people in the basketball arenas that social distancing that the NBA is in Orlando.
Well, in fact, they've done that with the families now, Bob. They've done that with the families.
Okay, you can put comparably 1,500 people into the arena in Edmonton for these two series. Mm-hmm. And you could have done the same in Toronto. You could put 5,000 people in a baseball stadium with the same kinds of restrictions as the NFL. But it is the National Football League, but more specifically, I suppose, the state of Ohio and the two teams there that so far are the ones that have decided to do this. Not sure that's the right decision, John. Not sure that's the right decision.
Well, it wouldn't happen in our country, Bob.
No, it wouldn't.
It wouldn't happen here. But it also goes to the perceived love and devotion to the sport that exists in a place like Ohio.
Well, but it's disregard for the for you know what's going on in the world. You know,
no question,
America has been the most guilty country in the world of total disregard for the reality.
I can't argue. I'm actually shocked that I thought the National Football League would have learned a little bit from what's gone on in Major League Baseball. Because, I mean, how would you define the baseball season, Bob? Unmitigated disaster? Where do you put it?
So. Well, I mean, based on what?
Well, no, I mean, I don't know. I mean, based on the amount of COVID cases. There's nobody in the stadiums. I mean, heck, Joe West tried to kick out the general manager of the Washington Nationals out of the stadium because he wasn't wearing his mask yesterday. But are you concerned enough? And football is obviously, I think, the one sport that this is going to be a little more difficult to manage because of how close people are to each other when you play the game.
Well, the players, essentially. Yeah. Players and coaches, but, you know. And, yeah. I mean, I saw a college football game the other day or parts of it, and one coach was wearing a mask all the time and the other coach wasn't. So, you know, and that's part of the problem, I think, too, is, you know, decide what's, you know, just, is there a reason why a coach shouldn't have a mask on? You know,
no,
really?
I saw highlights of a high school football game in Georgia on Friday night, and there had to be 3,000 people in the stadium. And nobody was wearing a mask.
Yeah. Well, let's see it all the time.
Yes. No, and you're going, come on, folks.
I know I said that was the last thing. We should acknowledge the passing of Lou Brock, who until Ricky Henderson came along was the greatest base stealer of all time by a country mile. Mm-hmm. And a really, really great player. And we've now seen a couple of very, very high profile baseball stars from our, dare I say, youth.
Yeah, Tom Seaver.
Last week, and now Lou Brock. You know, two of probably 10 or 15 guys that kind of stand out for me when I was a, you know, more of a youngin'. And sad to see them both gone.
You know, Seaver's, I mean, when you think about Seaver's legacy and the length of time that he pitched, and Met fans, you know, still talk about the day he got traded to Cincinnati as one of the catastrophic days in the franchise. But when you think of Lou Brock, and it goes, you talk about your childhood, Bob, there were base stealing is a lost art now. I mean, because the game has changed so much and the science of the game has changed.
The value of the stolen base is
right.
Has diminished.
But I mean, for me, it was Maury Wills, Lou Brock, Ricky Henderson.
Thank you.
And
the greatest of all time.
Yeah. And I mean, when the Cardinals were a juggernaut in the late 60s, you know, winning one series and losing the other, to me, he was one of the most exciting players. I mean, when he got to first base, it became a cat and mouse game. It became there was true drama in the baseball game, the way the game was managed then, the way the game was played then, and Brock could make a difference almost every time he got on base.
Well, I remember thinking that more than Henderson and more than Wills, that Lou Brock was the guy who could steal any base he wanted to at any time, and it was not even going to be close.
Yeah.
I didn't care who the catcher was. I didn't care, you know, who the pitcher was. I didn't care how close they kept him. Lou Brock could steal any base he wanted, any time he wanted. And I'm sure that wasn't the case. Statistically, that would be proven to be incorrect, I know. But nonetheless.
And he played for a franchise. He played for a franchise where there were lots of other sports in St. Louis. But the Cardinals, they're on a pedestal higher than any other there.
And they love
people in St. Louis, people in Missouri love their baseball stars and have looked after their baseball stars. How many, I mean, I remember going well past when Stan Musial played, but Stan Musial could walk into a room and everything stopped. Mm. And Lou Brock was like that too. Lou Brock was one of those guys in St. Louis as a baseball town. Lou Brock was somebody that was never forgotten and was always honored. But it also goes to the point, Bob, this is the first, you know, we're going through a sense of where television, we watched all these guys on television, and you know, we're getting to the age, and they're obviously of the age where that generation of people are passing. And we see it all the time now. We think we know them because we saw them on television so much.
It should not be surprising to anyone watching or listening to this. August show, that this is the longest one we've ever done.
No, it's not.
Oh, it is, John. By several minutes. It might be by 10 minutes. It's the longest one we've ever done.
Wow.
Which historically should be of no real surprise to anyone, because in all the years that you guested on the show or co-hosted
featured
when we were on radio and television, shutting you up is almost a thing.
And I didn't even get to tell some good stories.
Good. Save them for next time. They'll be okay. Just as pertinent. Lovely to see you again, and we'll see you again on Wednesday, as we will, well, we won't see them, but they'll hear us. And have a nice holiday Monday and Tuesday, and back at it on Wednesday for another podcast. We thank you for watching or listening. Enjoy yourselves. Sports in full gear right now. Lots of stuff to see, no matter what your favorite thing is. Enjoy it, and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.